Okay, it's time to talk wheels. It's the Car Guy Show with automotive consumer tips, industry updates, interviews, and enthusiast news. If you care about cars, this show's for you. Now you're tuned in, so let's get tuned up with your host. Here he is, Steve Ford, the Car Guy.
Hello and welcome to another segment of the Car Guy Show here, coming at you from the broadcast tower of News Talk 990 KTMS and at the speed of light on the World Wide Web. We're connecting you to automotive consumer and enthusiast news, insights, and interviews anywhere you're hearing our signal in Santa Barbara and the surrounding communities. In today's program, the topic we're going to put up on the lift is the second half of a two-part spotlight on the roots of the international vehicle brand Chevrolet, with a special focus on the highlights of Chevrolet's history with author Michael Davis, who has published a two-book photo narrative about the celebrated bowtie brand. And also joining us for this car culture visit is periodic co-host and collector car expert Roy Ace Miller, owner of East West Motors and the chief judge of the Palos Verdes Concord Elegance, where last week went into covering the highlights of Chevrolet's first decades after being created by William C. Durant in 1911. To recap, we touched upon Swiss-born Chevrolet and his advancements as a race car driver who just passed the turn of the then-new century, the 20th century, joined the Buick racing team, and how that led into his very brief involvement for several years at the outset of the company that would bear his name for now more than a century. And that is exactly where we're going to pick up to continue straight ahead with this segment coming your way after this break. The famed Chevrolet brand and highlights leading us through the middle and increasingly competitive international auto market of the later 20th century, as well as the arrival of the Corvette and other celebrated success stories behind one of the world's most iconic brands. Thanks for being on board for today's show. You're tuned in to the Car Guy Show on News Talk 990 KTMS, and we'll head over to join periodic co-host Roy Ace Miller and our special guest author Mike Davis when we come back. Hey, you know about getting the job done right. If you want it done right, do it yourself. Well, that's what car and truck buffs, owners of classics, custom cars, and wise consumers know when they visit Daily Car Bath, Santa Barbara's downtown coin-operated car wash supercenter for more than 40 years. After discovering Daily Car Bath for my own cars, I've returned to give my machines the superior wash and cleaning care that all car buffs appreciate. At Daily Car Bath, you'll find premium hog's hair wash brushes with conditioned soft water and five stalls with foaming high-sudsing auto shampoo that literally floats debris off your vehicle's finish, along with consistent high-pressure washing and available non-acid low-pressure wheel and tire cleaner. And for that special finish, DI&I spot-free rinse to help dissolve and eliminate mineral spot and spray wax formulated with clear coat protectant included in the cycle. See why Daily Car Bath is known as the place where customers send their friends. And take it from a fellow car buff. When it comes to the best in car care appearance, you'll find it all at Daily Car Bath, open 24 hours a day at the corner of Anna Kappa and Coda Streets. Quality, economy, and that showroom shine.
In the old-time movies, you used to see an automobile junkyard as a place with rusty old wrecks and big cranes scrapping obsolete machines. Those days were black and white, and today's a world of digital full color. And in the new era of the green car, Steelhead Auto Recycling is at the leading edge of used auto parts. As new and future cars approach 100% recyclability, more than 70% of even older car and truck parts find new life as they come back in service at Steelhead Auto Recyclers, which means huge savings for you. You'll save on major parts such as engines and transmissions, but you can also repair and refresh your wheels with money-saving body trim and accessory parts from hubcaps to glass, doors, fenders, taillights, and accessories. With a full-service counter and national parts search power and the new self-service section at Steelhead Auto Recycling, you'll save both ways, plus the security of a full 90-day warranty on all parts. Digital on the web at buyused.net or analog by phone at 683-8557. That's 683-8557. Steelhead Auto Recycling.
When it comes to keeping your wheels looking like new, the majority of auto glass businesses have state-of-the-art tools and equipment. What is harder to find are the industry industry certified craftspeople and the highest levels of service. Tri-County Auto Glass. Rock chip repairs or glass replacement with lifetime repair credit, a positive word of mouth reputation may bring you in. Courtesy, quality, and that new window glass shine will bring you back. Tri-County Auto Glass, downtown Santa Barbara, 963-6200. That's 963-6200.
Auto Parts, may I help you?
Yeah, you stock serpentine belts?
Serpentine? What do you have, a snake under your hood? Parts counter, what's up?
Yeah, I need pads and rotors for an 02 Ford Mustang.
Pads and a distributor rotor? You mean pads and drums?
No, pads and rotors. I think I'll try a few more calls.
Larry's Auto Parts, Phil.
I'm looking for pads and front rotors for an 02 Mustang.
Okay, we stocked the pads. What's your concern on the rotors?
Sounds like the pads have just hit metal.
Well, bring them in and let's measure them. There's a good chance we can machine them for a fresh surface and save you money, too.
Well, yeah. Hey, what about windshield wipers?
Well, we stock wipers and we offer free installation. And in most cases, just the refills without buying the entire blade.
More than auto parts, more than service. Along with a national CarQuest brand. Expertise you experience every visit. Larry's 8-Day Auto Parts, Old Town, Goleta, 964-3545. That's 964-3545.
I'm Larry's Auto Parts owner, Phil Unander. Our team is here to be your solution.
Change your life in a big way.
Well, having a mentor saved me. I did not have a father in the home, and my mother was ill most of the time. And Brent really is a great listener, and he really provided that extra leadership that I needed to really grow and become the person that I became. He's a great big brother.
Volunteer or donate to Big Brothers Big Sisters. We need bigs, especially men. Start something. If you're a former big, start something again at BigBrothersBigSisters.org.
All right. The legend of Chevrolet, the brand, and the race for horsepower and market share and sustained momentum from the 20th century into the 21st century. That's what's up on the lift for this segment of the Original Car Guy Show right here on News Talk 990 KTMS. If you weren't with us last week, we were looking at a two-book series under the title of Images of America, Chevrolet 1911 to 1960, Book 1, and Book 2, Images of America, Chevrolet 1960 to 2012. Do I have that right, Ace Miller?
You certainly do.
Okay, so back on with Roy Ace Miller, who operates East West Motors, the restoration collector car and enthusiast center where you can have a British car, an Italian car, or American Packard, or I don't know about a Rolls Royce, Ace. Does that come into your world? That you probably
don't. On occasion it does. I'll swallow my pride and look at a Rolls Royce.
There you go. You'll put up with one of those elegant silver shadows or what have you. We have Mike Davis on. Mike Davis, welcome back to the Car Guy Show.
Pleasure to be with you.
And we talked last week. We had a limited amount of time, as we do today, but I want to follow up and pick up on the fact that, folks, what we layered last week was that Chevrolet has a very dramatic beginning in which Louis Chevrolet, the race car driver, really plays a relatively minor role. Is that fair to say, Mike?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, came in.
The most that he gave was his name.
And folks would appreciate that Louis Chevrolet came over from France to Canada to then Brooklyn and New York, and then as a race car driver drove Fiats and ended up being hired by William C. Durant, founder of General Motors, at that time in the earlier years running the Buick racing team. And Louis Chevrolet was a great driver, and he came in there and became a part of Durant's world. Ultimately, where Durant used the Chevrolet name, Louis Chevrolet's name, when William C. Durant was later pushed out by his own board of directors, only to start Chevrolet as a separate operation when he was no longer with General Motors, and then bring it back into the fold. Ace, what year? 1919 or 1918? You were looking at the book, actually looking at Book 1, Roy?
Well, this book is very informative, and it's a real easy read because you have great tutorials, and every picture has a description of the individual or the situation, and it's a really fun way to get a history lesson.
Oh, it's great. Oh, it's copy table photo book, Mike. Would that be fair to call it that?
We call it a coffee table book, exactly, okay, because those are large format,
yeah,
and very expensive. This is relatively inexpensive.
But photographs. It's mostly photographs.
But it's all photographs.
Yeah, it's a great reference, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are about 225 photographs in each book.
With a good historic narrative of each one. Roy, you were looking at page 40 in book 1 as we were getting ready to go on here.
Right.
What's that Durant's photo there? Yeah. 1918.
Well, that's when they merged. After Durant had been removed, if you will, from General Motors, started his own car company, and that's where Chevrolet, as Mike so well put it, using Chevrolet's name more so than his services.
Right.
To start a new brand of car, which ultimately wound up being rather successful, allowed for Durant to become wealthy enough to buy his way back into General Motors. He had controlling interest of the company by buying stock from all the money he was making selling Chevrolets with his separate company back at General Motors. And then finally, he continued on with his crazy ways in running a company, and the board effectively removed him at the very end of 1920, in December 1920, and that was the final situation for Durant and General Motors. So, very interesting period of time.
No, let me back up. If for folks that are listening, it might be good to just recap a bit, just to confirm. We did identify for this segment from last week, picking up, that Louis Chevrolet was a race car driver, not really a car builder first. It was Durant that pulled him in to make cars, and they had some success. But Durant is a name people should know in the history books as instrumental in forming General Motors, but he was in and out twice, very controversial. So Mike and Roy, as we go to 1921, beyond William Durant, your book refers to the Knudsen years. What's significant about this story of William S. Knudsen?
Well, there are many things. He came from Denmark as a teenager, and he was a machinist, a bicycle mechanic, actually. But he was a genius at manufacturing in mass production. First, he became the guy at Ford Motor Company who built all the branch plants to enable mass production of Model T Fords. First, he did that. But after World War One, he parted company with Henry Ford and was promptly hired by General Motors, and within a year was the general manager of Chevrolet.
So William
Chevrolet didn't have much production capacity then. Durant is in the earliest years. He gets it launched, and Knudsen makes it successful.
Right. Roy?
Knudsen is much more the person who's responsible for Chevrolet's success than Chevrolet himself.
And of course it makes sense that obviously, William Knudsen's a manufacturing and production and hands-on kind of person, where Chevrolet was obviously a racer, right?
He was off building Model T racing equipment.
You move into the 20s and the 30s. Are there some highlights? I see, for example, in the middle of the book here, Chevrolet introduced its new Superior K series for 1925. It was the 2 millionth Chevrolet, and it was a coach for $695. So Chevrolet, Mike, was a pretty affordable vehicle at that time.
Well, but you got to remember the Model T was $200 and some.
Okay, so Chevrolet was an upscale from the Model T.
Definitely.
Okay.
And it was in terms of its features also.
Okay.
With the influence of General Motors in its many divisions, there were such things as color paint. You remember the old business about Henry Ford saying you can have any color of a Model T?
Black. Yeah, yeah.
Chevrolet with its connection with the DuPont Chemical Company had fast drying color paints. The reason the black was preferred by Henry Ford because it dried quickly, and therefore you could achieve mass production, big numbers. Okay. But there were a lot of other engineering developments that Chevrolet and General Motors brought in, say between 1925 and 1935. Probably the most significant of those was for Chevrolet, that was advertised in this fashion, a six for the price of a four.
Okay.
That was 1929.
That was 1929.
Right.
And that went on. That engine was still being used by Chevrolet as late as 1970.
Wow. The same design.
The six cylinder. Cast Iron Wonder was one of its accolades.
Okay.
Then in the Depression, the most significant thing, I think, was that Chevrolet had to have two different size Chevrolets, what I call the Depression Chevrolet, which was a shorter wheelbase than the top series of Chevrolet. So they had two distinct Chevrolets. They didn't look much different, but in fact they were.
Well, as you go, now I'm flipping pages in the book and I'm looking through it, it looks like a series of successes right through as you approach, gosh, you know, you go to the war years. Anything notable there about the war years when you know well, Mike, you wrote a book about the arsenal
of democracy? I think the main thing was that Chevrolet had this huge manufacturing capacity, and Knudsen was in charge of what was euphemistically called defense production for the whole United States then.
Right.
You might say for the Allies, because we, Britain and Russia in particular. I don't identify any particular thing at Chevrolet during the war. They just had enormous capacity to build trucks in 1940 and 41.
Got it. Roy?
Yes.
Hey, we accelerate through then. Mike, if I've got it right, we've got Chevrolet and General Motors integral in helping the manufacturing for the arsenal of democracy during World War II. It was a rough time for the world. And for folks listening right now, we're talking to Mike Davis, who's author of two books and many others. Mike, before we wrap up, I hope we can touch base about the other books you've written that people might want to look up on the internet or find out from Arcadia Publishing. We're talking about Images of America, Chevrolet, Book 1 and Book 2. The first book, 1911 to 1960. The second book, 1960 to 2012. And our guest is Michael Davis. And Mike and Roy, I see then we go into the book, and it's a photo history book with captions. I think it's very interesting. We go to the 1950s. Roy, observations on Chevrolet. We have Corvette in 53. Any thoughts as a Concord Elegance judge and a person who watches the marks and brands over history? What do you think about the 50s for Chevy?
Well, it was interesting. It was a real staple. Chevrolet was a real mom-and-pop kind of car. Not all that exciting. I mean, there were some people who were supplying race equipment for Chevrolet, but generally their image was just a family sedan and not much more. And I think the management realized that they can't depend on that forever, even though the cars were very popular.
Right.
And the Chevrolet was the Corvette was the was a product of new ideas and refreshing the image of Chevrolet as a whole.
A halo, right? 1953.
Well, yeah, but pretty much, yeah, a halo kind of thing. But mechanically, it was pretty mundane. It was still strictly an old Stovall 6.
Yeah.
With a power glide, no less. It didn't even have a stick shift in the early cars.
Sure.
And so it was swoopy. It was a classic.
They only built 300 of them.
They only built 300?
Exactly, the first year. Yeah, the first year was a very... And in 54, they built a few more.
All right.
In 55 was another year that they only built about 300 or 400.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Roy, pardon me, but may I interject something?
Yes, of course.
I just, thanks, because I think as you come up on this, I'm looking at the book on page 112 in book one. We come up to 1955. Roy, why wouldn't they have dropped that 265 V8 in the Corvette sooner, since it was in development? Or make it the first model to get the small block?
Well, I think you just answered the question. It was in development. They knew they had to come out with it, and they weren't holding it in the wings, so to speak, for the right time. It just all of a sudden it appeared. And it's interesting. 1955 is a very interesting year for Corvette. There were a few, if you can believe this, six-cylinder Corvettes that were sold or manufactured, or they're tapering off the manufacturing of them, in 1955.
Yeah.
Basically a clone of a 54. And then the rest of the year they built just a few hundred of the same car. It looks like a 54, only with that new V8. And it was still with a power glide, although there were a handful of them with three-speed shifts. It just they were like... One off.
And those are probably worth quite a bit today, right? From your collection.
There are one or two here in Southern California. I saw one at a Concours. I almost had a heart attack. I didn't know one had existed. And this gentleman showed me his car, and it was a three-speed 55 Corvette with a V8 in it, and it was as hand-built as any car General Motors has ever built. It was almost like a prototype.
Why didn't they make the transition? Yeah, well, that's interesting. Why didn't they do more of that configuration?
Well, they came out with an all-new Corvette in 56, and it obviously celebrated the 265, the new V8, and it had three-speed stick available, and very quickly after that, the Corvette became much more the sports car it was meant to be.
Absolutely. Mike?
Well, I think the other thing was that the racing was just really getting going at that time, shifting from the dirt tracks to things like the NASCAR Daytona 500. That transition is occurring in the early 50s. The other thing was the introduction of sports car racing.
So that Corvette was a part of
Corvette
that?
Corvette did it.
Corvette. Yeah. What? Go ahead. How did the sports car racing connect with that?
Well, it didn't very much in the beginning. They weren't competitive. But okay. After the 56 cars came out, and they start with the V8, and that was the engine lent itself, as we all know, to modifications and performance enhancements that made the engine legendary.
Absolutely.
And which is now the year 57, all of a sudden, now we've got four-speed transmissions, and we have Rochester fuel injection.
Yeah. What year was fuel injection? Was that
57?
57. So folks would appreciate that in the United States, you know, today every automobile has electronic fuel injection. Back then it was mechanical fuel injection. But 1957, going away from carburetor, that must have been the talk of the town for Detroit, Mike, to have Corvette coming out with fuel injection. That was like,
well,
you know,
fortunately, for the industry, they didn't work very well. Everybody had them to one degree or another, but they didn't work very well.
Okay, so it was early on technology, but it was still pretty cool. The big Chevrolet news for 1955 was this 265 cubic inch small block overhead valve V8 engine, Chevy's first V8 since 1918. The 162 horsepower V8, along with the companion Corvette, dramatically changed Chevrolet's image from the value-oriented but stodgy family car to a fashion statement and perspective performance king. So
exactly right.
Yeah, that's what you said. And then, of course, Mike, you've got the 55 in the bottom of that page. The Bel Air, the 55 two-door Bel Air V8 hardtop, sold for, let's see, does it say a price? I don't know. What is it? 20,
yep. 20,
no, 21.
Right there.
Yeah, there it is. And Mike, you've got your book there probably. $2,166 got you a 265 V8. And tell us about Ed Cole. Ed Cole's inside these pages, too, a famous engineer for General Motors.
Yeah. Ed came up through Cadillac. He was an engineer's engineer. He worked on Cadillac tanks and tank engines during World War II. And then those they began developing the overhead valve over square V8 at General Motors and introduced two new engines for Oldsmobile and Cadillac 48.
That was a Kettering engine, right?
I think Kettering is out of it. I think this was pretty much Ed Cole from the Cadillac and General Motors research staff.
Yeah.
The essential thing is that Kettering was retired by then. He was on the board of directors of General Motors.
Okay.
Sort of their technical expert among all these bankers.
So essentially, if I'm tracking right then, as we go into the 1950s and look to today, General Motors had Chevrolet as a very powerful division accelerating through the second half of the 20th century. The Corvette is a halo for an otherwise stodgy family car company, as you explained it, Roy. And Mike, Ed Cole came in as an engineer who was using the best of equities, I imagine, Roy, to some extent. Boss Kettering, a famous engineer who was there for the self-starter back in 1912, 1913, still had an influence into the 50s, perhaps.
Well, overhead valve engines were developed by Buick at the very beginning, at around 1904.
Maybe not introduction, but in what models on GM in
1949? No,
Oldsmobile. Sorry, Buick didn't have it until 53.
So even though Buick had overhead valves, Mike, back early on in the 20th century, it didn't come in mass.
Well, the overhead, and in fact, there were quite a number of engines. The so-called Liberty engine, aircraft engine, was an overhead valve engine. First World War.
Leyland produced the Liberty engine. I don't think it was his design, but that's a whole other story.
Everybody ended up going to it within 5 years.
So
a little bit more than that.
So it was aviation that got overhead valves.
Really. The cost of developing those engines for the independents was one of the factors that caused Nash, Hudson, Packard, Studebaker fail. They had to borrow so much money to develop those engines, the V8 engines, the overhead valve V8s, to be competitive with General Motors, Ford, Chrysler, that they couldn't pay off their debts, and that's why they failed.
So that's a technological battlefield of the 50s. The overhead valve technology of the 1950s, and what Mike just said, had to do with the technological advancements, where those independents you referenced, Mike, were left behind because the mass production and mass capitalization of the larger automakers allowed them to advance forward with retooling and advancing the engine technology. Is that a fair assessment?
Oh, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
So now we go forward into the 1960s, 1970s, and the present. Chevrolet was dominant through the 60s and 70s and 80s. It was the import battle in the 1980s that really diluted the U.S. dominance of the Ford, Chrysler, General Motors leadership of all the car brands. Now we have more than 40 brands in the United States. Any thoughts about the 70s, 80s, 90s?
Those attempts to deal with the imported cars were valiant efforts indeed.
Yeah.
And I guess in their own way, they were successful. They sold quite a number of those smaller cars.
Yeah.
But they never stopped the tide from coming in.
Yeah.
You know, the Toyota, especially Asian cars, and Volkswagen, of course, were really making the product what people wanted and kept gaining market share.
Absolutely. Well, then, as you look to the 90s and into the 21st century, you see Chevrolet holding on where Oldsmobile has gone away, Plymouth has gone away, Pontiac has gone away. Am I missing any other one, Roy or Mike?
Mercury.
Mercury.
Yeah, Mercury's gone.
Yeah, so you look at what was inevitable, predicted in the 1990s, of the battlefield of the international automobile market, whether it's Europe or the United States right now, global platforms.
Well, you can't leave trucks out of it, you see. Okay. What's happened is that trucks, two things have happened. The automobile business used to be almost all domestic automobiles, and then you have the influence of the imports on the one hand, and then trucks begin, or what are called trucks, begin supplanting passenger cars.
Into the 1990s, and into here as we come into the 21st century, Chevrolet endures in a marketplace that has had a fierce shakeout.
Well, yeah, just it became more and more competitive, no question about it.
Yeah.
All sorts of reasons. Don't forget, the imported cars were imported. The beginning,
yeah,
but there are probably more people employed building cars in this country by overseas car companies now than the domestic car manufacturers are producing. So there are other stories, other reasons why overseas manufacturers have gained such acceptance in this country, and it's not just because they're made elsewhere. It's just that they seem to be a product that more people identify with for what they want for their own purposes. So that's a whole other chapter, but. Yeah, it started off with them making inroads from bringing cars in this country and became so popular they started producing cars in this country. Well, Motown just started declining.
Observations about the current marketplace out of the 80s, 90s, and into the 21st century. What I'm looking at is Chevrolet has endured, Mike. That says an incredible story about a company that has continued to adapt to the market. Where other car companies we mentioned, Plymouth, Pontiac, Oldsmobile, what's the other one? You said Mercury. Have gone away. That was the thought I had as we hit the 21st century. Mike, you've devoted yourself to history. Your two book set, Chevrolet 1911 to 1960, produced by Arcadia Publishing, the second book, Chevrolet 1960 to 2012, takes us from the beginning, the roots of Louis Chevrolet as a race car driver and William C. Durant, the huckster, the salesman, the Wall Street Wheeler dealer, the in and out of General Motors, founding the company and then being pushed out eventually. Fascinating stories. And Roy, what I think is interesting to observe with you as a historian and a Concord Elegance judge and a radio broadcaster when you're on board to look at history like this, it's a privilege to be with you. Any closing observations as we hit this, where to get this book, Roy?
Well, I tell you, this is these two books are a great chronicle of Chevrolet. And think about it, Steve.
Yeah.
If you put both of these volumes together,
yeah.
We've got 101 years of Chevrolet.
Yes, a century.
And they're a great chronicle of 100 years of car manufacturing. And how it all evolved, and the people involved, not just the
what color.
I personally think it's a great reference, and I don't consider myself a Chevy guy, but I can't help but flip through the pages and find some really fascinating information.
Yeah. Hey, Roy, that's an endorsement. I think can he quote you?
I guess I'm still comfortable saying I endorse these books.
Okay. I'm Roy Miller, and I endorse these
books. Thank you, Roy.
Yeah. Michael, you go ahead and summarize, if you would, where can we get the Arcadia Publishing Chevrolet 1911 to 1960 and 1960 to 2012?
Well, the easiest way probably is to go to Amazon. And you also, they discount a little bit from the sticker price.
Okay. Can I lease these books? I'm kidding.
Hey, can you lease them? They're so inexpensive, you don't have to.
I'm kidding. I said when you said sticker price. What the book, they're about $20, right? The $21.99 is the sticker price. MSRP, Roy, is $21.99.
I think it's a good investment.
Okay.
Mike, Ace?
Yes.
You are generous to take time out of your day, both of you, to give part two of a story that could take 10 parts if we had the time. But you can read it all from Arcadia Publishing. You can find it on Amazon, were you suggesting, Mike?
Yeah, that's the easiest way.
All right, so you can go to Amazon, Mike Davis, D-A-V-I-S, Chevrolet, 1911 to 1960, and then 1960 to 2012. Ace Miller, you there? Here. Okay. Here. I know that you are ready to work on some fine automobiles over there in your collector restoration and fine machine world of East-West Motors. And Mike Davis, I want to wish you a great day as you go off to do what you're doing. A lot of material here. I am so thankful to be able to share both of your observations with the audience. And Ace Miller, we've got to go back to that marketplace because that is a topic. The evolution of the U.S. automobile marketplace.
I think that's a good idea.
Okay. The chief judge of Palos Verdes, Concord Elegance, and up there at Pebble Beach, fascinating stories you can tell right from those places by themselves. Thanks for joining me again today. And Mike Davis, across from Detroit, appreciate your time.
Thank you. I go back to my Mustang book now.
Ah, it's the book. Well, the book coming up ahead, folks. If you thought it was all Chevrolet, Mike's on Ford Mustang. Another history right now. Thank you both. And thank all of you for joining us for this segment on the World of Wheels. And this brings us to the close of another visit with all of you here on the Car Guy Show. Join us here again next week for another segment from the Coastal Riviera, right here in Santa Barbara on News Talk 990. KTMS, and the original Car Guy website at thecarguy.com. Keeping you car wise, I'm Steve Ford, the Car Guy.